What's happening in the canine industry? For all the latest news, views, and expert opinions, stay right here for the Canine Paradigm. You'll hear from industry leaders, experts, doyens of the industry, learned colleagues, movers and shakers, and the odd randy guest. Get the latest insights and expert advice from both here and abroad from the people in the know. Now, here are your hosts, Glenn Cook and Pat Stewart. And I'm Lofty Fulton, and I'm out of here.
Hey, I need to tell you something.
Oh, God, what is it?
Some time ago, we did an ad episode where we talked about how we were going to get better with our ads.
I was wondering where you were going. Yeah. We're so shit at the ads. That's what we said.
We said, we're so shit, we're going to get better, and we just didn't.
We don't. We're so full of shit.
All right, well, here they are. We got five sponsors currently.
All right, who are they?
First is the OG. The Iron Zawina.
Oh, that knob.
The Buffhead.
Yeah.
No, he's the OG. He's been with us since
good.
The start.
No, he's good.
He's going to sell you whatever you need.
Yeah.
He'll get it. What you should do is contact Jason from Ironswick Dog Queer with some peculiar product, tell him you want it, and make him get it in and sell it to you. Even if you could buy it somewhere else, just make sure he gets it in for you.
Just make that bastard work.
But in all honesty, I'd say 90% of my shit comes from him, and it's all the best stuff.
I did see some feedback on our forum where somebody was really intrigued about your handler package, the one that you got from Jason. Obviously, it works.
Yeah,
people are paying attention to the ads. That's great. Good. Even though we're shit at this, we do a terrible job of actually trying to keep things updated. It's great to see that the people who are investing in our show are actually getting some leeway.
Yep. Mate, I've heard that your wife sells some canine products.
My wife is doing great guns at the moment. I said before that she's been supported terrifically in the United States, which has been good, but I will swing that back home and say that so many more people in Australia are doing it. And it's great to see, like, there are people finally in the sporting dog world who are starting to prioritize nutrition for their dogs. And I know them. I can see them when Narelle comes in and says, oh, guess who bought some product off me for the first time. So,
are you saying there's no patient confidentiality?
No, there's patient confidentiality.
Oh, sorry.
It's just a mailing list.
Confidentiality.
Well, it's a mailing list.
Are you aware my dog is taking pee, collagen, and what's the other thing he takes?
Antinol.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been on that.
Antinol is not Narelle's business, but I've got to do a shout out for Antinol. They are absolutely fantastic. They're very supportive of our show.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we've done seminars and so forth, they have been first to dip their hand in their pocket. They are very generous with their product. But let me just say, all that aside, their generosity and their advertising and marketing, let me just say on the other side of that, their product is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it does work. It's very beneficial.
For sure.
It's one of those things where they say Antinol for every dog every day. I totally agree with that. Narelle has even supported that. When people have asked them about her product, she says the two things that I would absolutely give to you is Antinol and her Gut Protect formula.
Yeah, right.
Gut Protect is like her holy grail of
like
her whole range.
The flagship of the range.
This is not me market talking, okay?
Because we are. This is an ad.
This is an ad, but this is not me doing marketing.
But we've already pointed out we're shit at ads.
I know. Of all the things that she sells, and she sells some killer product, but the one thing that she does sell, which I absolutely agree with her, every dog should have this product, is the Gut Protect.
Really?
100%. It's nothing that they need for being sick. It's something that they need to do just to maintain great gut balance.
Okay.
And gut balance is like mental health. It's one of those things that you absolutely want to get control around. So products like Antinol, great for every day. Gut Protect, great for every day. There's other products that aren't even related to hers called things like Rosehip Vital and stuff like that. Absolutely fantastic for dogs to be on every sort of day.
Mm.
But I know there's other people we need to talk about. If you want to learn more about Narelle's products, go to our website, canineceuticals.com. I think it's
you'll figure it out.
It's .com or .com.au. It's one of those.
No one types that shit anyway. Everyone just Googles it.
Just Google it. You'll find it.
Hey.
Yeah.
George Kittredge. I reckon we should get him on the show.
We should have George Kittredge on the show. Yeah. Not only is he devilishly handsome, but he's got a fantastic, one-of-a-kind product that I've never seen replicated anywhere in the world. You and me were getting a car ride by him. We got to see the prototype firsthand. Yep.
And then his bike got stolen with the prototype on it.
It did.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, George has Rowdy Hound Dog Box. And so it's a crate that goes on the back of your motorbike so that your dog can go everywhere with you.
Yeah.
And it's cool as shit. It's a great idea. You should totally get one. Tailored Canines in Canada.
Yeah.
Do you know that Taylor from Tailored Canines is hosting Jazz Whiting later in the year?
I do know that. Yes. I saw the ad. Very good.
Yep.
So not only is she doing great stuff with her tailored canine.
Her training business.
Her training business, but she's also getting a fantastic trainer over there to help with her tailored training.
She is. And finally, Barbara DeGroote,
The sugar mama from the hot dog training.
From the hot dog training.
Just fucking throws cash at us.
Just supports the show. God bless
her. Yeah. I think later on the year when Narelle and I are over doing a seminar with Melanie Benware, Barbara De Groot is coming over.
I think
she has put down a like, and I said, you better come, sugar mama, and she gave me a thumbs up. So hopefully she's going to be there and I can give her some love to repay us for all the kindness and support that she's thrown at us and asked nothing in return.
All right. That's our ad.
Yeah.
That one's good to go for at least another 4 years. You'll hear from us then. Welcome back to the Canine Paradigm. I'm your host, Pat Stewart. I'm joined in studio today by my co-host, Glenn Cook.
Hello, sir.
You've been on an adventure.
I have been on an adventure. You've been on one too. You did a seminar over the weekend.
Yeah, I was down in Canberra. That was great. At the Canine campus down there.
Yep.
Had a good time. Worked some cool dogs. Was good.
Yeah.
It was fun. Nothing like Vietnam, though.
Vietnam is a trip, let me tell you. It's not unlike other Asian-ish countries that I've been to. Not that I'm worldly traveled and been all over Asia, but I've certainly been to Thailand a bunch of times and Bali. So I've been to Indonesia and Thailand. I didn't find Vietnam indifferent to Thailand. Same sort of environment, very hot, very tropical, very busy with lots of scooters on the road and stalls and marketplaces and those sort of things. It's got its own vibe for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Very friendly people, lovely, kind, friendly people. I never felt unsafe anywhere I went during the night or the day or any of the locations I went to. People, in fact, were very friendly, and I was chatting with people in the streets. One of the guys who rode a scooter, he saw me on the street. He rode past and said, "Do you need a lift?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You're from Australia?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, I love Australian people." And he pulls up his sleeve and he's got a tattoo of Australia on his shoulder.
Oh, wow.
Just a random random Vietnamese man on the side of the
road.
There you go. He told me that he's been to Australia before. He's got friends that live down in Wollongong. Yeah, he was just some random dude on the side of the road. But
how funny.
Lots of people, smiling, friendly, courteous. But talk about a hustle. Those people hustle. They're on the go all the time. They're like an army of ants, just nonstop marching. There's something going on all the time. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And you're there for a PSA trial?
There for a PSA trial. We had Tuan Van Lee. He organized to bring us over with impeccable help, I must say, through Tenoa. Tenoa did an amazing job with Tuan to coordinate this entire event and get it organized and coordinated, and get Nick Hill and Dev from India that came over to Decoy. And we had Adrian Ray from the United States who came over to Decoy. She brought her partner Dallas, and we organized to have Casey Kanan come over, our old bud. He did the stewarding. So as we stated at the end of the last episode, it was a real international affair. Mm-hmm. Like, there were people all over the world there. Mate, it was terrific. It was a real buzz. Like, I got there and I enjoyed it from the start. The food was lovely. The atmosphere was lovely. It was a good place to be. I definitely want to go back. I want to take Narelle over there and,
explore more
of it. Because we were right in Ho Chi Minh City. Ho Chi Minh City, it's a trip. There's scooters everywhere all the time. Like in many of those places, when you're walking across the road, you don't wait for traffic lights or a break in traffic. You just start walking across the road and all the scooters just hum around you. Do you remember the movie World War Z?
Yeah.
Where there's one person who apparently is sick and Brad Pitt sees it, and like all of the zombies just run around that person and just leave them there. Like, they don't hit them or interact with them. That's what traffic is like in Vietnam.
So oh my God.
When you're walking across the road, don't stop and play dodge with the scooters. Just keep going. They just know you're in the road. So some will beep at you to say, like, fuck off, but they will still just go around you. You just keep walking a straight line and they realize you're the chicken crossing the road. So you're just going from A to B and then move around you accordingly. It takes a little bit to get your nerve up, but because I've been to Thailand so many times, I'm used to that culture and I was aware that that went on. The trial was great. There was 9 dogs entered, 3 dogs got their PDC, 1 went on to have a crack at the first leg, but unfortunately wasn't successful. Great dog. It's got a IGP3. The dog's name is Cody. It belongs to a guy called Kwok. He's a very good handler. He's a good trainer. He's got his own training business over there called Silver Bullet Training. He did really well, but the problem was they just haven't had enough experience and exposure to PSA life.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So when the dog got out on the field, he was just hunting all of the distractions that were on the ground. Mm-hmm. So he lost quite a lot of points for that. And then there were a couple of things. He blew the long down, and instead of doing a AKC finish, which he elected, the dog did a service finish. So unfortunately, he lost a lot of points for that. Yeah, so we just couldn't get him through. I think if he got through the obedience, the dog would definitely get through protection. He's a good dog. He grips well. Mm-hmm. He's got very good nerve. And he's a lovely, well-balanced dog as well. So that was a shame. But nonetheless, they got three PDCs after a lot of limitations. One thing that I really do have to say about the Vietnamese team, very good sports.
Yeah, okay.
Nobody sulked. Nobody didn't shake my hand. Everybody came up. If their dog did something silly or rambunctious, they came over and said sorry and so forth like that. And I said, no, no, it's all good. Everyone said, it's fine, guys. It's all good. It's part of the PSA legacy or part of the trial stories. I love them. I really love them. I loved the entire time I was there. There wasn't a bad day in Vietnam. It was lovely. We went and saw the Chu Chi tunnels where they, during the conflict with America and Vietnam. So they showed us a way of living over there and how they built the tunnels. And then you can sort of go in these tunnels and squat down and crawl around underneath them. And yeah, man, it's amazing. It's just amazing.
Bummed I couldn't be there.
I was bummed you couldn't be there as well. We would have enjoyed you having complete the team.
Yeah. Wasn't on the cards this time. Maybe next time.
Hopefully next time. Maybe they won't ask me back to judge after I judge them so harshly. But I didn't judge them harshly. As I told them and I told you before in the Cliff Notes leading up to this, I wasn't there to do any unfair judging or any biased judging. It doesn't matter who you are, what you are, and how you mean to me emotionally, physically, and spiritually, whatever way. Like you present to me on the field, I'll judge you by the rules, not by how I feel. As you know, I've failed my own teammates for Iron Fist, and it breaks my heart to do it as it does for anybody else because I know the effort that goes into it. I know the passion that goes into it. I know the big feelings that exist into it. But as I explained to all the Vietnam team before we did it, you never want to accept a pass that you didn't earn.
Yeah, exactly. I own a printer. If I wanted to just have a certificate, I can print one out.
Yeah, or you can buy your own trophy. And
Exactly.
Mate, there's plenty of people I know who have done that before, who have got trophies on their mantles that they've gone to trophy shops and just had them printed. It's like getting calf implants or something like that and saying, look at the muscles I made.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all that sort of stuff is bullshit. And that exposes you as a fake.
Yeah.
Who would want to do that?
No.
Me as a judge, I won't do that. If anybody else does it, I mean, that's up to them, but I won't do it that way. I just won't compromise the sport or even my own integrity or my friendships with other people to say that if you look after Glenn, he'll give you a free pass. Not that they did that. They didn't do that, but I just don't want anyone to think that if they hire me to judge a trial, that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I want them to know that if you got that pass, you deserve to get it by the book.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I know I've said it before. It was great. It was a real experience. I love Vietnam. I'd definitely go back. The food in Ho Chi Minh City is amazing. There were restaurants that we went around. Again, as I said, Tenoa's organization and structuring everybody. At some stages, it's like trying to wrestle cats into a bag.
Yeah, yeah.
Tenoa was great. She kept the tempo. She kept everything running. She was organizing dinners and transfers and cars and flights and everything like that. She did so much work. And so did Tuan. Tuan, who was our liaison in Vietnam and translating for the team over there, both of them together did a great job in keeping everything going. And they should be really proud of their very first ever Southeast Asian PSA trial.
It's a huge deal.
We all made history together. On that weekend, all of us made history. It's one for the history books.
Yeah.
And we've done that here before with the very first Australian PSA trial, and they've done it in other locations. It was wonderful. It was a great experience to have so many people involved in so many different cultures, but all come together and all share a common love for the dog sport and a respect for each other and do such a fine job with what they actually had together.
Yeah, nice.
That's a summary on the Vietnam PSA World Tour.
All right. Yeah. Should we get into some of these questions?
Most definitely.
We must continue. We put on to the interwebs that we were prepared to do a AMA, Ask Me Anything episode. We've got
good feedback, feedback.
We only answered, there's 48 comments here. We've touched on two of them. But a lot of them are just people bullshitting with us, so we'll be able to skip through some and actually get into some topics today.
Yeah, cool.
First one off the cab today is Sandy Reeves, who says there are handlers within both law enforcement and dog sport who frown upon working, and she put those inverted commas, working dogs living within the household for fear of diminishing drive and or creating training conflict. Some of these individuals keep their dogs kenneled and the dogs are only brought out to train or to work. While I tend to agree there is a risk of creating conflict and diminishing the dog's enthusiasm if the dog is not appropriately managed within the household, I also know there are plenty of successful dog sport competitors who live with their dogs. Do not keep them in kennels away from the household. What should handlers be cognizant of when sharing their homes with their working or competition dogs? What sort of pitfalls should they avoid?
That's a good question. Like many of my responses where I frequently say we have spoken about that before in varying degrees, I still think it's a great question and one that warrants a good response,
yeah,
or at least a response. I'm going to talk about my own experience with my own dog in a minute, but what I will talk about is something that I experienced recently when I was doing a red team event with the Federal Police in Canberra and SOA were there. So there were a couple of members of SOA.
SOA is the Special Operations Engineer Regiment, which is they're the engineers in the army. So engineer corps people who are attached to special forces.
Thank you. Yes, because we need to explain those acronyms and everything to people. Red Team have done some work with SOA before where we've introduced HME to them.
Homemade explosive.
Homemade explosive. Thanks, Pat. So SOA, like most other organisations, do heaps and heaps of work on commercial debts. There are rules in Australia which says that agencies shouldn't be making up their own HME. Mm-hmm. And even some of their chemists just don't like doing it. They don't like the temperamental nature of peroxide explosives and so forth. So they worry about handling and transporting and so forth, and for good reasons. They're shit explosives. They're very temperamental and they're horrible things. So even we need to be really careful transporting. But enough said about that. So I was talking to SOA. We were at the Red Team event in Canberra. They had just come back from the Swedish Working Dog Institute. Mm-hmm. Mitch was there. He was team leader for the day. Mitch and I have known each other on a few of these events and we were having a chat. And I said, how was it? What did you find? And he said, mate, it was actually really good. And I said, what did you take away? And he said, one of the things I really took away was how much calmer their dogs are and how sensible they are in their searching criteria. And I said, what do you attribute that to? And he said, I'm glad you asked because I asked them that. And he said, they have stopped kenneling their dogs and they're letting the dogs come home and live with them as a family dog. Mm. And he said it's taking that edgy, manic behavior away from them and it's allowing the dogs to bond better with the handler and also have proper downtime and just live a normal life where they don't go kennel mad. Me being involved in kennels and seeing the effects of long-term kenneling on dogs, I've seen myself how different it can make a dog versus a dog that's had a more settled and more serene lifestyle where it does have proper downtime, where it's not just you go in the morning and all the dogs are rousing and there's activity and there's explosions happening and dogs are not getting their needs met or not getting out enough. Because sometimes when that is happening, although it's convenient, it may not be good for mental health. So now that I've said that, I'm going to travel back in time and I'm going to talk about my raising of Harley when he was a puppy and my inexperience and lack of knowledge that I had then. But what I did defied what everybody told me to do. So everybody back then told me, don't have a close indoor relationship with your dog. Don't let your dog on the bed. Don't let your dog do this. And they really were in the days of don't let your dog run in the door before you. Don't let your dog exert that sort of dominance over your lifestyle. And I never listened to any of them. My dogs always ran in the door before me. Even though I taught it as part of a criteria, I never believed in it and I never did it as something that I thought this is what I did. I did at the start. But then I kind of thought nothing's changed from when my dog runs in the door before me. Like nothing's changed. Like the dog hasn't turned around and said, well, fuck you, I'm locking the door on you or, you know, like
I'm the boss now.
I'm going to stand here and show aggression to you because I got on the door first. Nothing changed. The dog just ran inside and went to the area it wanted to be in, like finding its toy or, you know, running into the water bowl or something like that. With these sort of things, you have to observe with your own eyes and contemplate with the gift of your own brain. And when I did that and I saw it for myself, I realized nothing's changed. Like nothing has made this dog display any different behavior from when I did all of the pre-work of getting the dog to sit and drop and then me walking in the door and letting the dog come through. So I want to retract what I said before when I said I didn't do it. I did do it at the start, but then I stopped doing it because when I was lazy and not thinking about it and letting the dog run through, like I said, the results were the same no matter what. The dog went to the same areas and did the same things. I had that talk with somebody several years back, probably about 15 years ago, just before I moved to Sydney, and someone said, it's probably because you did all that primary work at the start. That's why nothing changed. But I don't believe that. And the reason I now conclude that I don't believe that is because all the dogs thereafter, they all run the door before me. They don't give a fuck. They just run in the door and I don't give a fuck because they're doing the same thing. They're just running. They're going to the location they want to be. Now, if you need control because you're elderly or because your dog is very rambunctious and you don't want the dog coming in and sliding all over your slippery floors and doing shit like that, you do what you got to do. That's the song that I quote to people all the time. Do what you got to do and be what you want to be. Like, do what's necessary to fix the shit in your home. That's fine. It's just normal obedience and coaching that we do with ourselves. And people do it with children. They do it with their spouses. They do it in their workplace. All those sort of things exist for a reason because people have trial and error mistakes before where terrible things have happened because they haven't developed some sort of policy or procedure around how you let your dog into the household. So if you've got like glass doors that your dog could go through or fragile things that puppies can go spinning into because they're too highly aroused and you need that level of control, do it. Do what you got to do. Get through whatever you need to do so you and your puppy, young dog, older dog, live a happy and fulfilled life. So I was told, don't let your dog live in the house with you. Don't let your dog sleep on the bed. Even my unwitting grandmother used to say the same thing to me all the time, but her thing was more about germs. She always said, don't let dogs breathe in your mouth. Just absolute nonsense. Harley slept on my bed all his life, and yet he was one of the most balanced-minded and one of the toughest dogs I've ever owned. He was very clear about everything he did. The only thing that he did do, like if he was on the bed and he was lying on my feet and I went to kick him, like to move him, sometimes he'd growl at me to say, ah, fuck off. That was it. That was the worst possible thing. He never bit me. He never redirected onto me. He just like grumble at me that I tried to move him off the bed.
There's a whole episode in that, the way that Roddy's, I know it was a Roddy Cross, but
they're grumblers. They speak and they mumble and they grumble and they can be
a Rottweiler growling at you is not the same as a Malinois growling at you. If a Malinois growls at you, you got a problem.
Right.
Because that's indicative of what's coming typically. But when a Roddy growls at you, they're just kind of
they're grumble bums.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like somebody sighing or something like that. Like it's like,
yeah. But that's a really scary thing to talk about because, of course, sometimes they're fucking growling at you and it's dangerous. You know what I mean? Like there's lines to that.
That in itself reminds me of that image of the Roddy growling in the girl's face on the couch and the pit bull doing the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like that's not the same thing I'm talking about.
That's right. Yeah, there's degrees.
Right. There's lots of comments where people say, like, if they're growling at you, they shouldn't be on your bed and so forth. And there are times where I certainly agree with that. There's times where I've been around and mediated those synergistic behaviors in houses before and I've said, oh, I wouldn't be having that dog on the bed because of what the dog is just doing here.
Mm-hmm.
You are at risk and you are in a vulnerable situation where things can go terribly bad in those sort of situations. However, with my situation, I had him since he was 7.5 weeks of age and he died when he was around 12. That was a 12-year relationship where he traveled with me and Boyd. We used to go on the road and do tours and training things with other people. And I always snuck him into the hotels and he'd come and either sleep on my bed or next to Boyd and growl at Boyd while he was on the bed with him. But he always came in. He always slept on the bed. He always had that relationship with me. And I feel that we had a better relationship with each other. We knew each other a lot better.
Mm.
I would love to have Randy sleep on the bed or sleep in the bedroom and stuff like that. But the problem with Randy, as I've expressed on the show before, in which people have challenged me over multiple times, but you got to understand, guys, I don't say this because I'm just being lazy or I don't want to train him or I can't train him or anything like that. Randy is just different from all my other dogs. He can be controlled and he can do a lot of great things and he's got a high level of obedience when he was in his prime and I could do a lot of really cool things with him. But he just can't settle inside at night and he doesn't really like it. It's quite aversive to him to put him in those sort of situations because then he really does feel that he's been suppressed in those sort of behaviors. What he does love is he loves coming in and sleeping in his crate and so does Mando.
Mm.
And Randy will protest if you don't let him sleep in his crate. Like he wants to go in the crate. He just doesn't know how to interact with the house. When he gets put in a place in the lounge room, he'll sit there and he'll squeal and cry and whinge. And then people have suggested things. Why don't you do this? Motherfuckers, listen, I have done this with people all my life. I know that my dog suffers. Like he really internally suffers for those sort of situations. So basically what you're trying to tell me is make your dog suffer so it makes me feel good about you not having your dog do these sort of things.
Mm.
I know what he needs and I know what he wants. So I put those combinations together and, of course, my wants and needs as well. Like I blend all those together and I say, here is what's best for the dog. Narelle or I let him inside at night. He runs straight into his crate. He literally goes bowling straight into his crate. He sits in there. He's very patient. He waits for his treat and he goes straight to sleep. Mando does the same. He runs straight to his crate and he sleeps like the dead all night. And there is no pressure on them. They want to do it. Mando would sleep in the bedroom better than Randy, much better. He still likes to move around at night and do all those sort of things, but nowhere near what Randy does. Mm. So my suggestion to everybody before I make this overly complicated and too much long-winded is know your dog.
Mm.
And that comes through everything you're doing. And know your lifestyle as well. Like know what the house needs. Look at it from a house perspective. What does the house need to maintain harmony and spiritualism or whatever it is that you need in that house? What do you need to do to maintain that? And that is knowing how you, your dog, and your family all react together and know what, like even having visitors to your house, know how that will impact you. Because ultimately, that's what causes so much stress and so much distress for people is they don't know what they want. They're getting mixed advice from everyone, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. Like I said, I'm a 30-something year veteran in training dogs and I still get people arguing with me about what I should do with Randy when I know what he needs and I don't have conflict with that dog because we just do what makes him feel good and makes us feel good, works for him, works for us, and the whole house is in harmony. As I said before, if your eyes are seeing actual behavior that's working and it's generating results, either through the advice of anybody who gave it to you or your own interactions, and you think to yourself, this is pretty good. I feel good about this. My family feels good about this. The dog seems to feel good about this to the best of my knowledge. And you're not doing it. You really need to go step in front of a mirror and have a good hard look at yourself and a big word with yourself because you're ignoring your eyes can physically see and what you know, not what you believe, what you actually know to be true.
Mm. I agree with all that entirely, but I think there's a dog component. Some dogs are going to be much more capable of doing that than others. And I think that when we're talking working dogs, it can very often be the source of their drive. That's one of the things that we sort of have to take into account is that some bloodlines of dogs, well, actually, across different breeds of dogs and then bloodlines within those breeds, the drive comes from different places.
Absolutely.
And so some bloodlines, especially say in Malinois and it's certainly in Shepherds as well, a lot of their drive is nervous energy and that they need to be moving sort of all the time and they're kind of on sort of a hair trigger. So if you have one of those dogs, those dogs like to be moving a lot. They don't necessarily want to be or even are really capable of happily being in a lower state of arousal when there's things going on because just the movement and lifestyle is going to kick them into a higher state of drive than other dogs.
Mm.
Like my own dog, for example, Remy, his drive is mostly from possession and conflict. He enjoys possession and conflict. And so that's what allows him to do the work, which he doesn't have a lot of nervous energy, you know, as much as a Malinois cannot. Like it's still very, very high by comparison to other dogs, but not by comparison to Malinois.
Yeah.
And so he's a dog that is presently capable of being in the house, but with caveats, and I'll explain that in a moment. So I think there's a very strong genetic portion to whether a dog is really capable of doing that. And as you just highlighted, like, of course you can train a dog to do whatever you want the dog to be able to do, but there's a cost-benefit analysis that has to be done to that.
What was the name of the lady who originally asked this question?
Sandy Reeves.
So Sandy alluded to that when she asked what the consequences were for pushing those sort of things. One of those is being bitten by your dog.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. There's a genetic component from the dog and then there's the lifestyle of the home component as well. And that's a really variable thing.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I got Remy, my son was 18 months old. And so that really having a kid that's learning to walk and is bumbling around with a Malinois in the house that's also running around, like that's not conducive to a safe family household. So there's the issues of that. And I think that people have the way that they live with their dogs. Some people have a choice of whether they live with dogs indoors or outdoors. It's just a choice. Some people have a mix. And I think what's really common, what I see a lot in working dog people is some people have like a house dog and they have the rest of the dogs in the kennel. And usually the house dog is either a retired working dog. It's their old dog that has earned the privilege of becoming the house dog, or it's a different kind of dog altogether. You know, like how many times you get, like you and you have Frenchies, right?
Yeah,
and there's plenty of people who I go to their homes and their inside dog is
Cavoodle.
Yeah, Cavoodle or a King Charles Cavaliers are pretty common. That's what I aim to have one day. Mm. We used to call the Springers House Malinois because they're equally high drive, just less destructive in the house.
Yep.
It's very common that you see people have a house dog and then there's the working dogs who are out in the kennel. Mm. So that's just a personal choice, of course. I think that if the personal choice of the handler is to want a dog in the home and the home is set up and sufficiently capable of doing that, then there's the genetic component of is the dog capable? Does the dog actually want that? Is the dog into that kind of lifestyle? Imagine those two things do align. Now you've got to make some choices about the thing of dog training that I always kind of think is that you can have anything, but you can't have everything.
Yep.
And so when I get a dog, when somebody else gets a dog and I'm talking to them, I always sort of say, what are your priorities here? Because for most people, and probably most people listening to this in the pet dog world and have pet dogs or their pet dog owner, whatever,
yep,
the priority is that the dog is my personal cuddle thing, right? Like that's what I want, the dog in the house to enjoy the company of the dog. I want a dog that will interact with me and I can stare into the eyes of longingly and have a massive endorphin release. And I want a dog that sits with me on the couch and I watch TV with. So if that's the goal of the dog, then fuck yeah. Like start working on that shit straight away. You're immediately, nobody's suggesting that we just let a dog into the house holus bolus without any form of management, crating, that kind of stuff, right? Like there, of course, that sort of shit is required to not have your house torn apart. So let's imagine then just take that for total granted. We don't need to talk about that again. That people are doing the normal shit in management. The puppy's got a leash on it when it's in the house so it can be stopped from getting itself into trouble. When it's unsupervised, it's in a crate or a playpen, something like that, right? And it's getting the adequate amount of work and all the sort of shit to make it a balanced dog and increase the chances of all this being able to be possible. The truth is you're still rolling the dice if you get a dog and you go, okay, well, this is going to be my working dog. Whatever work is, it doesn't matter whether you're talking detection or to apprehend, whatever, right? If you go, okay, this dog is going to be this for me, that's his job, well, then that's your priority and decisions have to be made to keep that intact and everything else is a nice to have. So that's how I kind of think of it in terms of like what is a must have for this dog and, okay, if it's going to be a working dog, well, it must be capable of doing the work and then what is a nice to have? Well, I would like to have the dog in the home. So I will start to structure that dog to be a case of, well, it would be nice to have him in the home and I'm going to set things up to allow for that. I'm going to try and create a situation where the dog can benefit from being in the home and is likely to want to be in the home. But if that's starting to cost me in any way from the work, then I'm going to abandon that and criteria and start focusing on the working criteria because at the end of the day, that's what the dog's purpose is. And so, I can only speak from my own experience, but say with my own Malinois, raising him was a real blend throughout his whole adolescence up until he was probably 2.5 years old, I think, something like that, maybe two, of, he's in the kennel, he's in the crate, he's in the house, and he's just in the backyard. And there's various times that I'm going to allow for those things to happen, all of them with a view to the fact that I want him to be capable of doing the work, but I like the dog and I want to be able to spend more time with him. And for sure, I think that with him, he thrives in an environment where that balance is met. He does well in that. But that's not to say all dogs will do well in that regard. I think some dogs don't like to be in the house. Some dogs get like a lot of nervous energy as to like, this isn't where I want to be. A lot of the time we sort of think that opposites are extremes apart, but in fact, they're the same thing varied only by degree. So some dogs, they need total open space or to be locked in a box, but a big box is somewhere in between and that really can fuck them up. So like being in a home, so like some dogs, like Randy, for example, he's like, no, I need to be in a crate. Like you need to put me in a very small space where I don't have to make any decisions because
he just can't handle the arousal of being in here. Like you said, it's that intermediary for him that it doesn't do well with his head.
Yeah.
And there have been multiple times where we've thought, we'll cave to it and we'll try again to see, like now he's older. I've tried it. I've brought him in. It hasn't changed anything.
Yeah.
And then it creates conflict.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I'm thinking, the only reason I did it is because I'm caving to the wants of other people, not from the understanding of my own dog. So the only reason I actually caved because other people were putting pressure on me through social media and saying, oh, he's older now. Shouldn't you try it? And I said, it's not going to work. I know my dog, But then I thought, oh, maybe I should try. Like I caved and I tried it and it didn't go well.
Mm.
He was very stressed about it. He was running around. He just cannot handle the different levels of arousal and it really puts his head in a bad place.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think that all has to be taken into account.
It does.
Is the dog even want it? Is the dog capable of it? Is the household appropriate for it? Do we have young kids? What type of dog is it? Because some dogs, you know, they make bad decisions. Like some of the more powerful and the impulsive dogs, they can misread situations. They can make bad decisions. So the household has to be suitable for it. And then the combination of the two have to work out. There has to be a certain like, okay, I'm going to put in the work into this. And it's a lot of work.
Absolutely, it is.
And there's risks as well. And the risk can be, as you said, you could create conflict in trying to force a square peg through a round hole. So now that's going to leak into your training. So in some instances, having your working dog, and certainly in mine, I think this is the case with my dog, is that it leads to a more level-headed, more capable dog because he's not worried about when his next opportunity to spend time with me is. My dog, certainly like most dog trainers' dog, has borders on separation anxiety to the point where it's not actually separation anxiety. It doesn't cause issues. But if I'm gone, like, I was just down in Canberra for the weekend and I drove down. So I left at like 4:30 in the morning and then I didn't come back until lunchtime the next day, which is roughly how long I can be away from my dog without it causing any problems at all. He's still totally fine in that period. But any longer than that, I start to think, well, somebody is going to have to go and take him out, right? Like somebody's going to have to go.
So have dog, to manage that
a,
drive.
Yeah, a dog person is going to have to go do dog things with this dog.
Yeah.
And so Jane sends me a photo of him at 9 o'clock at night. Instead of being where he would normally be in his bed asleep, he's downstairs staring at the door, right? So he's like in anticipation of me coming back. It's not a case of he's problematically has separation anxiety, but he depends on me heavily when we're home because he's like, you are the gateway to all the things that I enjoy. Mm. So without you, I'm potentially never going to get to do all those things that I enjoy. And so he needs interactions with other people who can give him those things.
Well, it's the way they're being programmed by us.
Exactly. Mm. Like we've
programmed our dogs to be the image of what we wanted them to be, but then there's spillover to that sometimes.
Exactly.
As a caveat, while we've been talking about this, I just want to add to this because there'll be people who do have their own offside kennels in their houses and so forth. The reason why I wanted to add this amendment to this is because there'll be people who have listened to me just talking about dogs go kennel crazy and so forth. Yet I know scores of people all throughout my term of working with dogs that have had kennels outside their house, either right next door or like a shed across the way if they've got property. And those dogs have been perfectly fine and perfectly balanced. There's been nothing wrong with those dogs. The reason I know that is because I've been there and I've seen their dogs running around, integrating, going for pack walks with them and so forth. And that really is the beneficial secret to it is they don't exclude the dogs from their life.
Yeah.
Like the dogs aren't in there for 11 hours of a 12-hour day and then sleeping in there for the rest of the night. The dogs are out. They're in the yard. And a word that you were alluding to before but never actually dropped it was what we want to do is get generalization with our dogs.
Mm.
That if you need to pop them in the kennels for a period of time, they're fine with it. If they're inside and they don't mind that environment and they're fine with it, great. If they're out in the backyard and they're like that, once again, great. We've achieved what we want to do and we've also got that generalization that our dogs can be in those environments and they can thrive.
Mm.
And that really is ultimately what we're aiming for is thriving in any environment we put them in. And if you see that they're not, then address it.
Mm.
Do something about it. Like that step up and advocate for the agency of your dog. And that's the thing that I'm trying to suggest to people is we've talked about advocating for our dogs before many, many times, especially on this show. And if you can see that your dog is suffering in an area, like suffering isn't about physical pain. Suffering is about mental anguish as well. And that's why I said before, and I'm mentioning this, Randy is in mental anguish when he's inside. He doesn't know how to contain himself. He spins out of control. Him and I get into conflict with each other and then I feel punished by it and he feels punished by it. So that is very much the term of conflict. We are opposing each other's feelings and beliefs at that point in time. We're not melding or integrating with each other. We're not on the same level. We're at war with each other.
Mm.
And I hate it and he hates it. He doesn't like it. So we don't do it. He's in the backyard most of the day. He's happy. He's got his shit to do. And he does demand to come inside at night. And I want him inside at night. I don't want him sitting out there getting cold or too hot. I want him coming in comfortable, sleeping and resting so he can go back out and enjoy the rest of the day.
Mm.
Do the same thing with your dog. Advocate for your dog. Understand how your dog thinks and feels about any given situation. If it needs to change for a training or safety purpose, as you said before, when dogs need to make better decisions, again, step up, advocate for your dog. Realize yourself, there's a strong possibility I haven't done the right programming here with my dog. Mm. Strong possibility of it. And even then, if you're in conflict about that and you don't know what you're doing, as I've said before, that's the time to call in a professional or a second set of eyes. Get someone to come in and have a look at the situation and get a read on it and tell you what needs to change or what needs to be done, or possibly even it's a hopeless situation.
Mm.
So I've looked at dogs in houses before and realized straight away it's a hopeless situation. Completely unfair for the dog because the goals and the expectation from the household is way beyond the capability of the dog. It's people expecting that they have a Mensa student in their house and the dog is like a got the brain of a third grader.
Mm.
But yet they're saying, I expect Einstein, but I've got Ralph from The Simpsons.
I think the last thing I would say on it is as well, again, it's polarity in that opposites are the same measured only by degree, and that is that some dogs have so much drive that keeping them in the house isn't going to work out for them.
Yeah,
they're incapable of taking it off. But other dogs don't have enough drive to work and live in the house.
Mm.
And so sometimes dogs that could really be easy keepers, they also need to be crated or kenneled more in order that the amount of drive that they have is expressed when you need it to express. And
yep.
that the dog doesn't just think, well, I got a great life on the couch. If that's the case, you know, maybe the dog is better suited to just being someone's pet. Maybe the dog does want to just be someone's pet. And that's a different conversation.
Yep.
But I think that's my take on it, is that there's no right or wrong. There certainly is a right or wrong by the dog, and there certainly is an appropriate and inappropriate via the household. And you just have to kind of, when the two of those come together, consider what is the ultimate purpose of this dog and that North Star, like what is the most important thing that I'm working towards here, balance that against what would I also like, and then, you know, live with the dog appropriately after that.
And reassess.
Yeah.
There's nothing to say that, you know, when you use the North Star analogy before, aiming for the North Star always means course corrections, reassessment,
yeah.
like constantly look at it and address with your household, where are we currently? How do we feel about this situation? Like
yeah.
have a house meeting and ask the members of your family, are we happy with the way this is working? Analyze the dog, as Tyler Mudo says, which is his business name, consider the dog.
Yeah.
Totally look into the wants, needs, and desires of the dog and say, are we fulfilling these or are we really fucking these up?
Mm-hmm.
But they have to coincide with yours as well. As we've mediated through this whole conversation, this needs to be something that we are electively thinking together, and agency is addressed on both sides, not only the dogs, but ours as well. Because ultimately you can have a happy dog in a fucked house simply because you're living the internet's version of what a perfect dog life is.
Yeah, exactly. I think exactly as you say, reassess and don't rush any of this stuff.
Yeah.
My dog lives in the house most of the time. It's all happy. It's all fine. But like I said, that was like a 2-year process because it wasn't important to me. It wasn't something I was even in the back of my mind when I got him. It was like, it would be nice if he could be in the house and be a house dog.
Yep.
But I'm not even really going to put too much work into that because I have a toddler and his job is to be a working dog. And so he's in the kennel, he's in the crates, he's in the yard. And then intermittently, when it's appropriate and he's tired and I can count on nothing going crazy and I can do all the management, he's in the home. Those windows of being in the home just slowly increased and increased until they're the overwhelming majority now. And as I say, he can be alone in the house without anybody there, but it doesn't matter whether there's 100 people and I'm not one of them or there's no one in the house, the same outcome to him. He doesn't interested in anyone else but me.
Yeah.
Is that at about that 36-hour mark, he starts to go, hey, someone should put me in a kennel because I'm about to lose my mind. And so he just goes in the kennel. No big deal. All right. I reckon we've hit that.
Like many other opportunities where we're trying to squeeze in multiple questions, we're pretty much going to get to two again.
No, this will be a quick one.
Oh, will it?
Okay. Yeah. Oh, this one from Natalie Compton. If there isn't anything on the dark and scary taboo topic of suppression, I'd love a few minutes on that. No. Next question. We must someday do that. Or is today
Natalie,
the day?
You can thank Liam Little Bitch.
Yeah, he's been tagged.
For that.
And he's been tagged in it.
Oh, has he?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Liam just got a leg of his one with his Roddy. Good work, Liam.
Great work. He actually sent me his PDC with his dog. It looked great in its PDC.
Yep. Good for you, Liam. Doing it with a Roddy.
Yeah. Congratulations, mate. Terrific to know that the Roddies are stepping up.
Next question.
Yes.
Courtney Down says, is it worth pursuing e-collar training with clients in Queensland if the e-collar is on its way to being banned across the country? Kind of thinking it's worth trying to give e-collars a good name. I'd say yes. Here's the thing. If you're in Queensland and if you're trained in the use of an e-collar and an e-collar is the right tool, that's what you should be recommending your clients. 100%. I wouldn't worry about any looming banning. And right now, as a trainer, if it's the right thing to do for a person and their dog, if that's what you think is going to give the very best training outcomes for them, you should absolutely be using the e-collar if that's the appropriate thing. And if they're banned in future, that's up to your client to stop using it if necessary or continue using it if they deem to.
So I just want to make an example of something that happened recently while I was in Vietnam, and I heard about it on the news, and it was absolutely horrifying that it happened. When I use this example, I will say that I'm thinking of all the people and I'm expressing all the sensitivities that go along with it. So if you do have an issue with me discussing this, it's more about you than it is about me, because it's been on multiple news streams all over the world, all over the country. But while I was away, there was a tragedy in Australia that took place in Westfields in Bondi, where a guy went on a stabbing spree and killed women, babies. Like, it was horrific. It's absolutely terrible. Heartbreaking stuff. The point that I wanted to make out of this is in Australia, we have excessive gun bans. People might say they're excessive or people might say they're just enough. We don't have a culture like what they do in the United States, where you have the freedom to own various different types of firearms. And there are people over there who say there's a reason that they're having shootings and problems. But what I want to say is we have most of the population over here, most of the population aren't allowed to own firearms for various given reasons. Now, some people do, and you're definitely not allowed to own pistols unless you're law enforcement or that you belong to a shooting club. And we don't really see many random shootings unless they're through criminals and they're ill-gotten gains with guns. My point being with this is even though people have removed a lot of firearms and don't allow you to have tactical or repeating firearms and blah, 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 it still allowed this psychotic person to go off on a stabbing spree within a group of people in a shopping center. The parallel that I'm drawing to this is taking e-collars away from people won't address the problems that people have with dogs. I've told people before on so many occasions there needs to be an education about this. And people might think at home, well, that's ridiculous that you've made these two conversations between guns and knives and then e-collars versus not e-collars. What I'm trying to say is taking e-collars away will never be the answer to fixing people's perception of what's in the best interest of the dog versus what they deem to be cruel. Because when you take e-collars away, as we've addressed in earlier episodes, people are still going to do things that are cruel and they will take it underground. Like they will start importing things that are horrible and temperamental in its use and its behavior with dogs. If it's in the best interest of the dog to use an e-collar and you are trained for it, if you actually have education in it, like I have education in owning firearms and all sorts of things like that. I don't have the desire to want to go and mass kill people. I don't have psychotic episodes where I'm on heavy forms of medication. And I know there's people out there who also are on medication and don't feel like that. I know that I'm using lots of sensitivities and so forth in this conversation. The problem for us is we seem to be, all of us around the world, seem to be locked into this mindset that having an e-collar automatically makes you a person that's going to abuse an animal's educational pathways. And yet, I know thousands of people, thousands around the world who I speak to on social media, and I've personally witnessed them training dogs with remote trainers, prong collars, slip leads, correction chains, and the rest. And I've never seen in my experience, my knowledge, my understanding of what is cruel, I haven't seen those dogs suffer in my presence. I haven't seen the dog show evidence of a residual of suffering. I haven't seen it. And then people say to me, well, it could happen when you're not there. It could, and it will in some degree with some people because that's how they deal with and cope with their own frustrations. But do you think that's not going to happen when you remove these tools? Do you think when it was the better call for the dog and now that it hasn't been allowed to be used, do you think that there's not going to be higher levels of frustration? We're already seeing a spike in aggressive behaviours in dogs. We're already seeing that. The statistics don't lie. This is from our very own government agencies who record statistics in bites. Like, they're going up. Incidences with dogs are going up. That itself must determine and must dictate that there are issues when people are taking away tools, or when there are beliefs that one style of training needs to dominate every other style. I keep repeating myself. I keep saying it. I've said it through episodes. I say it when I'm educating students and so forth. The answer is education. The answer is also reaccreditation. You wouldn't tolerate watching a child being beaten by an adult in a shopping center. You wouldn't tolerate it as a society. People would intervene. They would step in and they'd say, that's out of control. I don't care if that's your kid or not. This is not how to raise children. It's not even the way to treat another human being or an animal or whatever it is. I know from my own experiences, all of the people that I have any form of professional relationship with would do exactly the same if they saw that happening with a dog. If they saw it at a club, I've seen it when clients have walked in before and they've done intolerable behavior with dogs and everybody has stopped and says, hey man, that's not how we run down here. This is not what we do. This is not how we conduct ourselves with training. That's not training. That is abuse.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way for that animal to be able to control itself in that given situation. It pisses me off, if you can't tell already, that we're already still locked into this, we got to give up on the use of e-collars and other training tools with dogs, because I kind of feel in my heart and soul and with what I know, my experience, that's going to give up on a lot of dogs. There's going to be a lot of dogs that this is the end for them.
Mm.
And I've expressed it as best as I can in the past that this is heartbreaking for me. Like, I'm watching the downfall of a lot of dogs who would have had a fighting chance. Now they won't. This is the end for them, like literally the end. And if we're not fighting for that, somebody wanted to talk about suppression before, that's fucking suppression. Mm. You being suppressed into an aligned way of thinking that is, the appropriate word is nefarious and sinister.
Mm.
End rant.
We've had people on the show that tell us that they don't train with any tools anymore because they've seen the light. You know, in their past, they trained with tools and they were abusive and misused the tool. And like, I always sort of think, do you think I'm fucking stupid? Do you think like what happens in your heart and your mind that allows you to be abusive to a dog has nothing to do with whether you're using an e-collar or not? And if you fucking think for 1 second that I don't know that you're beating the fuck out of your dog now that it doesn't have an e-collar on it,
mm.
you can call yourself as force-free as you want and you can call yourself that on the internet as much as you want.
Well, just don't expose yourself with your shitty internet videos, your social media
stop
videos.
Stop showing the fucking videos where
Your dog's twitching and flinching away from you.
Stop showing the videos where people who actually know how to read a dog can tell that you've beat the fuck out of your dog.
Yeah. Do you know one of the most outrageous statements I ever heard was, punishment is reinforcement for the handler.
Yeah, that gets thrown around a lot.
Oh, that itself, the fact that somebody thought that up and feels proud that they can echo that throughout the world just goes to show how much you don't know about human beings and that you don't know about love and compassion.
It tells me about them.
That's what I mean. It's
that
them.
Individual.
That's what I'm saying. It's that person.
Yeah.
It's the person who uses those phrases and stands by it and will die on that hill. They really must hate people that they say and repeat phrases like that. Like, they must have an absolute disgust and hatred for people.
Well, mate, they have it for themselves.
Explain.
Well, they hate themselves.
And you don't think they don't hate other people?
Well, of course they do, but you can't even like someone else unless you first like yourself.
Good point.
That's where it all, you know, we're straying from the question of I get my clients to use e-collars. But what I'll say, I've done a lot of this kind of work on myself and I've fairly well researched on it, is what you accuse others of doing, you can only see what you claim to hate in others, you can only see if it exists within you, right? And so the majority of the people who will tell us how we are abusing dogs and make an assumption that we're abusing dogs with e-collars or any tool, either have or would do that themselves.
Mm.
Here's an example, and it's the same one I always use, all right? I can't control myself around salty, delicious carbs. Can't do it. I don't have the willpower. And listen, yep. I'm a person with a fucking decent amount of willpower, right? Yep. Now, evidently, I think there's actually a gene. I want to blame my genetics for this and not my poor willpower. However, if you have like hot chips or fries or, you know, whatever people call them, right? Especially if they're lathered in chicken salt, right? The amount of them that I can eat is none of them or all of them.
All or nothing.
There is no fucking way in hell. If there's a bowl of chips on this table, I cannot touch it. That's no problem. But if I eat one of them, I'm fucking eating them till they're all gone. And I can't stop myself. And I'll sit there and I'll be sickened by myself. I'll be fucking disgusted in myself as I'm putting more into my mouth. Because I can't help it. I don't have the ability to stop. It's a huge character flaw of mine, but it's one I'm acutely aware of.
You're talking to a fat guy, so don't look at me like for misunderstanding. I totally get it.
Yeah, and evidently it probably has a lot to do with – you know, like I would have been a great caveman. I store fat for the long, cold winter that's never going to come.
Yeah.
And when I find the payload of calories, I'm fucking eating them, right? Like, and no one can stop me. But I think there's a lot of people who are the same with crossing the line into using aversives on dogs. The amount that they can use is none or a fucking lot and they can't control themselves. And so the thing is, I don't think that you should not be allowed to eat hot chips. I think you should be able to eat as many hot chips as you can. Because I sometimes see people just eat one or two and I'm like, I look at them and I go, wow, fucking good for you, right? Like, like you have a skill that I do not have.
Yep.
Fucking good on you. And I look at them and I go, wow, look at you sharing those hot chips. I run away. I fucking pick them up. I'm like, excuse me, guys, I got to go. And I leave with the chips, right? Because I can't help it. I can't. But when someone else can, I'm like, hey, good for you, man. You got something going on that I don't.
Yep.
What I don't say is like, you're not allowed to eat any fucking chips because I am bad at binging chips. So there you fucking shouldn't be allowed to have any chips.
Look at you turning this into education.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. This is what I see. And so
I like it.
We see that with all the tools and all of that. We've been down this road a million times is that more often than not, the people like, and there's people who are in our Facebook group that get, you know, persnippety about this all now and again. I'm like, hey.
Persnippety?
Yeah, persnippety.
Yeah.
Like, I get that you feel very guilty and are disgusted by yourself because of the things that you've done to dogs in the past. And you might have done those things with tools in the past. And maybe you're a different person. Maybe you had a mentor that told you to do it. Maybe that was just the culture at the time. And whatever led you to feel this way, when you reflect upon what you used to do to dogs, it makes you sick. And you assume that I'm doing the same, but I'm not. I'm not doing anything to dogs that makes me sick. I'm not doing that. And when I reflect on all of my training, when I look back at my sort of training, because I never was from a compulsive background, I don't look back and go, geez, I was overly compulsive to dogs. When I reflect on my training and I'm being hard on myself, I think, geez, I wish I had a better skill set at many times in various ways. I wish that I'd read dogs better. You know, there's lots of things that I wish I was better at. But I never sit down and think, fuck, I fucked up a lot of dogs because of the influence of other people on me, you know, all those sorts of things. Like, I don't think that, but there's clearly people that do. And that's your guilt to have, man. Like, you have to work through that yourself. I can't help you with that. That's up to you. But changing what I do is not going to rewrite the fucking past and fix what you did in the past.
100%.
So maybe instead of just reflecting on what you did and assuming I'm doing the same, take a good look at what me and other balance trainers are doing and look at it and go, oh shit, different from what I thought.
They won't do it. They seem incapable of doing it.
Well, here's the thing. I'll admit, while I watch you eat hot chips, it makes me want them more, right? Maybe that's why they have to do that, right?
I'm not making light of this situation. I'm not making fun of these type of people. However, I was listening to an avid, force-free, anti-tools person stirring it up. Same sort of thing. Don't do this. Drink our Kool-Aid. Come over here. On another note, the same advocate was in social media expressing their childhood where they faced abuse. And I thought, I can see where that comes from. I can understand that. I too have faced some pretty unjust behaviors from parental figures as a child. Not my mum. It was my stepfather. I understand that. But that doesn't make me want to hurt dogs. It doesn't make me want to hurt other children. It doesn't make me want to do all those sort of things. But there are other people that kind of feel like I was abused as a child. And like I said, I'm not making light of this. I get it. It's pretty hard sort of stuff to grow up with. I was abused as a child. So therefore, I don't want anybody to have the capability to do it to another human being or to a dog. Now, automatically, and as I've said before, we're confusing consequences, normal life consequences that exist inside the human house or in nature itself. We're confusing that with abuse. This is the partition that we always seem to get fucking stuck on, is I know what abuse is. I've been at the hands of it before. And I also know what punishment is because I've been punished before. And I know the variation. I know the difference between the two of them. I know what it is. I've experienced it before. And when I punish my dogs, all I'm saying to them is you can control the next thing that happens. Like, it's up to you. Do you want this to happen again, or do you want to avoid it altogether? And that's what nature gives all of us at all times. Nature is unrelenting. It fucking teaches you, if you fuck with things, you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. And this is what happens as a consequence of doing that. There is no lesson like nature. But then I hear people saying, well, the human being shouldn't have the right to wield that in their hands. Some people are fucking intelligent. Some people are deep. Some people are really educated and they chase education. Most of those people I've been surrounding myself with for most of my life. And yeah, I've told people before, I've made the mistakes. I've done regrettable things. But I've also been pulled up on them and I've been shown better ways by people and I've wanted to pursue those better ways before. And there are multiple people that I know who have been in exactly the same situation where they've been juveniles, they've been adolescent and they've been adults and they've grown up and they've realized, hey, there is a better way. And I've seen the light. And that's not always insistent on now you must abandon all tools, now you must abandon all forms of consequences and so forth and only do this way of training. I'm not going to answer that question because you already did with the hot chip scenario. Like, I actually feel like what you just said is a very good example. Because you can't do it, then you want to project that onto everybody else because you can't control your own demons. You can't control your own inability to keep yourself focused and disciplined. That's a generalized sin that's been expressed on everybody else because you can't control yourself.
Yeah. Last thing I'll point out, two things, is people who are going to do shitty things to dogs are going to do that whether they got a tool to do it or not.
That's what I'm trying to say before, and I may have done it in a very bad way. I may have not explained it in such a simplified term, but they are going to do it. It's going to happen. Like, they will find the means to do it.
You can abuse a dog with food by giving it too much or too little. You know what I mean? Mm. It's the same thing.
You and I have talked about that before, and I saw on a forum where people used that example of you and me having that discussion and said that was a ridiculous example to use in an episode.
Really?
Yes.
Well, fuck you. I'd use it again because the majority of people, like, you look at the cases. I looked at this a long time ago. I can't remember all the numbers, but you'll have a hard time finding someone who's been charged with abuse of an animal that used a tool to abuse the animal. Mm. People use a fucking leash. They hang the dog or they kick the fuck out of it or they starve it. Most of the animal cruelty charges are from starving animals. That's a fucking really horrific, prolonged suffering that you're putting the animal under. Mm. And so that is totally unnecessary. And we've all seen morbidly obese dogs that are in constant pain, that can barely fucking move around, that are suffering because Mother Nature doesn't tell them to stop. They don't have that ability. Mm. So if you just keep giving it to them, they'll keep taking it. But the last thing I do want to, you know, it's always important to point out is that we're talking about the people who are so anti-tools and want the ban. That's a very small minority of people. Yes. The overwhelming, that's a very, very small minority of people. And I think that people should be free to train dogs however they like, so long as it is humane and ethical. And of course, there's degrees to that. Yeah, that's a whole conversation in and of itself.
We express the caveats.
Yeah, we're for acknowledging sure, them. Just that you don't use tools doesn't mean that I think that you can't. It's a fair enough choice not to. There's degrees in that, and people who think that they don't want to because they don't like the idea of it just personally for themselves. And there's other people who just have decided to play the game on hard mode. Like, there's many and various reasons, and they're all fine. It only becomes an issue for me when people start trying to ban things. And what's very uncommon is that anybody who wants to ban something actually knows how it's used. Mm. Because if it's being used at an international high level of training, then chances are it works really good, right? Because most people just want to be successful, right? Especially when you look at competition dog sports, if it didn't work, people wouldn't do it. And that's why we have within the sports is the attitude of the dog. That's an important criteria of many of these things. And so if it didn't work as a training modality, when people say, oh, balanced training doesn't work, it's like, well, fucking, are you kidding me? Go to a dog sport trial. Go and have a look at it. But also, yes, the dogs can do it, but the dog has to still enjoy doing it because the tools and everything come off for the trial. Mm. Anyway, enough on that. We've probably pissed off enough people.
Probably, but if I find that something is going to be banned or I'm going to be told that I can't do it anymore, at least I want to know that has been surveyed and judged by an intelligent group of people who aren't being exhaustive with their emotions. Effectively, what I'm asking for is I don't want to be governed by people who can't control how they feel.
Yeah, if things get banned, certainly things do. Your regulation comes in on all aspects of our lives. I want to know that it's been properly considered unemotionally.
Absolutely, yes.
And looked at a data standpoint.
Exhaustively researched,
yeah,
by a peer group of balanced people who aren't checking in with their emotions. Of course, you are going to feel things about certain given criteria. It's a human right to feel things. But as I said to you before, and I started this talking about the trial in Vietnam, it doesn't matter how I feel about you. I can love you and I can hate you in the extremes of each other. But if you step on that field with me, I won't judge you by the way I feel about you in real life. You're in no danger by me being judged that way. All you'll be judged by is what's in the rules.
Yeah.
And that's how I expect other people to judge me. If I'm being judged on something, they should remove how they feel about me personally and say, let's look at the work and I'm going to judge the work and the work alone. That's it. That's how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I know I'm asking a lot from some people when I ask for that, because I know that there are so many people who are unable to remove their bias from a given situation. They just can't seem to do it. And that's a shame. It's a real shame when bias comes into a situation. But corruption, bias, strong emotions, big feels, as we said before, they seem to interweave their way into general life planning.
Yeah. All right, moving on.
Moving on.
We've got time for one more.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one.
Okay.
Tasha Dooley says, okay, here goes nothing. Can you talk about shit? I mean shit eating, aka coprophagia. Did I say that right?
Coprophagia.
Coprophagia.
Almost, yeah.
I'm currently dealing with my own retired working lab who has an intense shit eating issue. I changed that word. It seems very impulsive, and I'm curious if you've ever dealt with similar issues with working dogs. The need to eat the poop reminds me of the dogs that need to hold something in their mouth, spin repetitively, or chew anything and everything. Like Pat Stewart with Remy, my girl isn't really retired and we're currently training for HR titles, but no matter the amount of work during the day, she still wants her poop snack if she can sneak it in.
Yep.
I should probably mention my girl has had 3 litters of puppies. I originally thought it was out of habit for cleaning after the pups, but it's been a year since I've had her and the habit has not subsided. Therefore, I believe she's had this issue for quite some time, if not her whole life. The best solution so far is muzzling, and I don't see her ever overcoming the urge. How about it? Can we talk about shit and other crazy compulsive behaviors and potential techniques to manage them? There's a couple of comments under here, people suggesting things to like try, like the products.
And, yeah.
So pineapple juice, fix my girl eating her own poo from someone.
Putting chili on it.
Yeah. Tried the forbid powder, made the dog nauseous and persistent, went straight back to it.
Yep.
So there are products you can get. There's a product, there used to be one, I haven't looked into this stuff in a long time, but there was one called SEP, stop eating poo.
Yep.
Pineapple is meant to do it. But I think if it's a compulsion, none of that shit works. The dog's just going to power through it.
So Ladybug is a notorious shit eater.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If she gets the opportunity, she'll put a dump on the floor and spin around and eat it.
Mm.
We've tried everything. We've tried product. We've tried all sorts of things. She knows if you see her, you're coming for her when she's done it, you know, like when she's going to do it, she immediately runs away from it. But that's more about seeing a 6-foot dude coming for her than it is about wanting to eat the shit, because left to her own devices, she'll spin around and eat that shit straight away.
Mm.
Interestingly enough, she won't do it all the time. She won't do it 100% of the time all the time. It's like the sex panther thing.
Mm.
60% of the time it works every time.
Mm.
So she's probably in that 60% category, probably about 50-50 whether she'll do it or not. Sometimes I see her sniff it and she's repulsed by it, and other times she sniffs it and she'll start eating it.
Mm.
But she won't do it in my presence. It will be in privacy. She's a snack-eating shitter, and that's just what she does. But it's out of frustration, and it's also genetic because her daughter Pixel does it as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing that I can do to stop her other than what Tasha Dooley was suggesting before. The only way that I could stop that would be from a wild muzzle where they actually can't physically get to the shed. There's nothing that has fixed the problem for us. We have worked with this sort of thing, and I've helped try to help people with this. And there's a moderable amount of people that have said, yes, it's totally cured it, mainly for the people whose dogs have got gut health issues. And we've addressed the gut health issues because Narelle
works. Yeah, so I think that there's two categories of this, right? There's dogs that are looking for something that they're not getting in their diet. Compensation for
improper gut flora.
Yeah.
So Narelle's helped the journey of heaps of people with coprophagia and done things like that. But for us to not be able to resolve our issue with one of the best canine nutritionalists and, you know, like a trainer that's been helping people for it for, you know, over 30 years, if combined we can't stop our own dogs for it, there's no point in pursuing it anymore. We just understand that that is what it is.
Yeah.
Even though we find it disgusting and repugnant and so forth, there's nothing that we can do to stop it other than euthanizing the dogs.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly it. I think there's two categories. There's a health category and working with a nutritionist and trying those products and all that kind of stuff that could work. It's definitely worth trying for everybody.
Yep.
But then there's like a genetic compulsion to do it. I just stalked you on Facebook, Tasha, and I think I know the bloodline of your dog. And I won't say the agency that I'm guessing bred that dog three times, but it's rife with all of their black labs. I've worked with that agency many times. That's the constant complaint of the bloodlines that they breed, is that they're really good working dogs, but they're really badly compulsive shit eaters. Because it's such a ingrained compulsion, like I for sure, if it were my dog, I would try punishment. And it would be like a whole punishment event. It would be a very deliberately orchestrated thing. And again, the actual positive punishment component of that would be quite mild. It wouldn't be any, like, I, you know, I would happily film this and put it all up, all my training. It would never be anything because you're imagining something, or sometimes people imagine something overly aversive to that.
Yeah. They're thinking abuse.
But the problem with that, and I would do it, if it were me, I would do it. And I've talked through people with similar dogs, I'm sure probably same bloodline or maybe even your dog's puppies, how to do it. It will come back because it's a genetically ingrained thing.
That's the problem is that you can
create an aversion to it, but Mother Nature is always going to be whispering in that dog's ear, hey, eat your own shit.
Again, when I was away and I was talking with the bunch of trainers I was with, we were talking about the lure that alcohol has to an alcoholic. You know, and they can be 10 years sober and have one drink and that's it. Like they're right back where they started, and that's like shit eating with dogs.
Yeah.
It's that same compulsion that as soon as they have it, they just think, nah, that's it. I'm on the train again.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the same sort of thing. We see this with, say, like Kelpies chasing bikes is a great example. You get a lot of, in my area, I don't do it so much anymore, but I used to do, that was a big part of my work. My bread and butter was Kelpies that would chase bikes. And you go through all the differential reinforcer, all the bullshit to make sure that everything's in place and the dog's still chasing bikes. You go, okay, cool, we're going to punish this away. And without a doubt, you can guarantee 18 months to 2 years later, those people are calling you because it's back.
Within presence, it will go away. Like Ladybug won't do it in my presence. She will not shit on the floor and eat in front of me or Narelle. She just won't do it. If we're out of eye and earshot, there's a good chance she'll do it. Mm. Like she'll have a crack at it. Like if she shits on the floor or shits on the ground in front of us, won't touch it, won't turn around, won't look at it. It's like that event just happened. I'm just going to look at something else.
Mm-hmm.
Without our presence there, we know she shat because there's crumbs and we know
there's crumbs.
Yeah. Yeah. The main thing is, let me just tell you this from Narelle doing so much gut health work with her. Thank God she has good shit. That's right. All I can say. That's the only plus to this horrible, yucky event that makes my stomach turn is that thank God she has good gut health, because it would be just a nightmare if she had sticky shit or something like that. Considering that we're talking about shit, those sort of things are important. Like it's basically like winning a firefight by burning out an area and at least stopping it from spreading any further.
More than 10 years ago, I worked at a daycare. These guys, you know, I've told the story before. I worked there for a month while I was still in the army just to sort of see what it was like. And there are still two dogs that I can remember, a whippet called Jim. And,
Jim the Whippet.
And he was a fucking cool dog, like a really cool dog in every aspect, except you were constantly keeping him away from other dog shits.
Yeah.
And there was a lab. I can't remember the lab's name, but he would, as the dog was doing it, he'd be running over to eat it fresh out of the like me putting my head under an ice cream machine.
Oh, yeah. Straight from the tube.
Yeah. And it was just
horrible. Drinking from the bottle.
Yeah. Ugh. And then, you know, in a daycare setting, like they get the odd one every now and again and then they spew that.
It's a disgusting.
Whole disaster. Yeah. So, yeah, I feel your pain. Glad that I've never had a dog that does that.
Now that we're talking about this and on this subject, I had a friend, and my dogs have done it before, where they've eaten like the manure from horses and cows, even possums and stuff like that. Like for many dogs, that's like us eating an Anzac biscuit.
Yeah, that's very normal.
For omnivore or even carnivores to eat the feces, there's a lot of undigested grass matter in it, and it's actually quite prebiotic and probiotic rich for them to do that. So the only thing that I've never liked my dogs doing is running and sliding through manure and then me having to deal with it. But if they've eaten like cow or pasteurized manure and stuff like that, if they've been eating stuff like that, I never really freak out about it. It's not that I encourage them to do it or allow it or want them to do it, but if they are doing it, I just sort of like shoo them on and just say, come on, let's go, rather than making a big fuss about it and getting stung up about it. But yeah, their own poop is just not cool. Unfortunately, we live with a poop eating dog.
What a way to end the episode.
Yeah.
Well, there it is.
Yep.
That's it for another episode of The Canine Paradigm.
Yep. We went all over the place with this one.
We did. Like, that's our nature.
Yeah.
We got upset about people, and I'm sure that's going to get us in trouble. I'll be getting a bunch of messages about that I won't read.
Man, we've had some funny ones lately, haven't we? Some people that just want to make this show political.
Tell us what's what.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's their prerogative.
Yes.
All right. If you like the show, you probably should like, rate, share, and subscribe.
Yeah.
Tell your friends.
Yeah, do that.
Do all the normal stuff.
Do it.
We always say it every time, and every now and again one of you does it. But yeah, like, rate, share, do all that.
I want to tell you, like, if you're thinking about going to Vietnam, pull the trigger.
Yeah.
Go over there. Go visit Vietnam. It is a cool country with some really sweet people.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah.
Do it.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
If you want to support the show, best way to do that is to jump into Patreon.
Yep.
A few bucks a month, get you a giant backlog of information, more stuff going forward. You could pay 10 bucks a month, see the live stream. Did that this morning. Yep. All went really well.
I saw that because I could see all the Patreon messages.
Oh, you can see them come through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do that. You could give us as much money as you wanted, to be honest, like if you're into that.
Wouldn't that be cool if somebody just gave us $1 million just for the hell of it?
Each?
Why not?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd be into that. What would you do with it? Consider, because we have said and we have held true to the fact that we have never actually withdrawn any money from that Patreon. We use it to buy equipment for the show.
Yeah.
So we now have $2 million to buy equipment for the show. What are we buying?
Well, I probably talked to you about buying a studio, like a proper studio and training area combined, like what Linus Tech did.
Yeah, okay.
Where they bought like a massive area and they hired people to come and actually do all their multimedia. Like I'd probably upscale the show and have an area where you and I owned it.
Yep.
It was ours. And it was like the coolest place on earth to come and hang out and train. It was basically like
Google. It's my shop now, except it's not. We're not paying rent on it, and it's not under the flight path.
Belongs. It belonged to us. Like it was ours. We totally owned it, and we can do what we want there, whatever we want. It was like Google for dog trainers, and
I'm quite proud of the fact that that's kind of what my shop is.
It is. You've got a cool vibe at your shop.
I love it there.
Yeah.
I don't have traditional customers in the way that a dog training facility would.
But there's a parking issue there.
And that's the issue. There's plenty, and it doesn't belong
to you.
Yeah, it's right. It's getting knocked down in.
That's right.
You know, 12 months.
That's the only thing I'm thinking of. Like I'm just thinking like having land, having a facility,
everything.
Having parking,
all right.
Having like Disneyland for your fucking dogs.
And we just make cool content.
And
from
cool
there.
Content, like constant content development, like a proper studio, whisper room, the whole lot. Like the things that we've been threatening to have. Like if money was unlimited and you had that ability to do so.
Yeah, that's what we'd do if somebody gives us $2 million.
There was a sultan in one of the Arabic countries that he had bucket loads of cash. He got one of his advisors to let people know that if they came to him and they had a good enough reason to give money to, he would consider it and give it to him straight away. So there was a lady that wanted to open his childcare center, and she went over there and she had this whole speech, and she was probably a minute into a 20-minute presentation, and her advisor just said to her, stop. And she said, oh, have I said something wrong? And he said, no, he wants to give it to you.
Perfect.
And it was like $5 million. She said, really? Like he hasn't? And she said, no, he's read your presentation already. You don't need to sell it. He's happy. Here's the $5 million. And he just gave it to her like that.
Yeah.
We need a sultan.
I've got a similar story. When I was at Yale, there was a guy, I mean, long story, but one of the professors was talking about, well, in order to establish a department that could do that, it was part of the astrophysics department. They were like, oh, well, in order to do that, it probably cost like $150 million. And he wrote him a check on the spot.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. All right. So 150 mil, Well,
why not? We could do some. We'd do some amazing shit with that. Imagine what we'd do. Like, it would be so cool
stuff.
Really cool stuff.
Yeah, we'd be able to make some good content.
Yeah,
it would be good to be able to afford a team that could help us do this.
Yeah, exactly right. Have a background team that we could just work on content and doing cool stuff all the time, but the team could actually do all the SEO, the background work, and just that be their full time job. And you and me would just educate, train, you know, like have a center.
That'd do cool stuff.
Do cool stuff.
All right, well, we can dream. In the short term, my camera got knocked over the other day and smashed. Yeah. So, like, Patreon, that's where money's going currently, fixing my camera.
Yep.
Which I appreciate.
Pat comes up to me and he goes, just going to let you know that if you see some money coming out for cameras, it's not that I'm buying anything else. He said, we're doing this training exercise and one of the decoys got slammed by Remy.
Yeah, and, he unexpectedly blasted Scott,
which is a good problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right, it's no one's fault. The camera got. And then
let me add, when if people were thinking, oh, well, why don't you put your camera in sensible places? We're talking to Pat. Like, he's always sensible. He's like Adrian Monk off the show Monk, where he considers all the options and puts his cameras and tripods in all the right areas. Like, this is the first time in five years that something like that has happened. So,
and it turned out it actually was like, it's classic fucking Sony. So the port, like, it only was that the USB-C port got damaged.
Right.
But that's hardwired to the board.
Right.
So that's why
it couldn't just be pulled out.
No, it's a whole board place. Right. Anyway, no big deal. Other one, buy shirts.
Yes.
That'll go towards building our giant facility.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the people who are going to get sent this episode and are like, listen what they said about e-collars. They're talking about you. Then they get it. The reviews are going to be like, and then they fucking beg for money at the end. We are who we are.
Yeah, that's right.
We're doing our best.
Yeah.
So do that. If you want to get in touch with us, best way to do that is to jump into the Facebook discussion
group. Yeah.
In there. And if you want to shoot us an email, that's how you can get in touch with us individually.
Yep.
We are info@thecanineparadigm.com. Love you. Goodbye.